Paris, could you tell me what the significance of this new dormitory is for the campus?
Well, it's just going to have many, many positive effects for us. Obviously, the one most needed right now is 250 approximately additional beds for students, and of course the flexibility of using those units at other times of the year that school's not in session for visiting faculty, for married students, and so on. It's just going to be a good thing for us in that it's going to take this artificial cap off of our enrollment, or at least somewhat off of our enrollment. As you know, we've turned away, by varying estimates, between 400 and 600 students, and we'll probably never know how many did not complete an application because they'd been warned, or how many never even submitted one because they had heard stories of no housing. In addition, the students who do get housed will be more comfortable. We'll have fewer people stacked like cordwood in lounges. We won't have to triple up rooms. And hopefully this, you know, as you know, this is phase one of construction. Hopefully phases two and three will continue on in the future. So we'll never again get to the point where the university can't grow normally because of something as artificial as housing.
Is this going to solve all of our problems?
It's not going to solve all of our problems. It's going to retain more students. It's going to make students happier. It's going to give us a better learning environment for students. It's going to give us more options as a university. You know, that's a bundle full of problems right there. Oh, well, you know, we've been planning this particular building for about 2 years, but we've been planning this complex since 1972. In fact, in 1971, in the fall, that was the first year that we experienced overcrowding. We had about 100 more students than we had beds, and I think the last student to be assigned a room got one in October. We had people in floor lounges back then. That's 13 falls ago. We, in 1972, in fact, presented a bond issue to the voters and had it approved for what would have been a $2 million complex very similar to the one we're now building. We got so far with that we retained an architect, had a design, set up mock apartments on the 8th floor of the Greening Building and had students come and look at them. And but as it turned out, even though the bond issue was approved, the legislature did not release the funds to us because between 1972 and 1973, we began to lose students. And our occupancy dropped to the point where we had actually two empty residence halls by 1974. So there was some concern about whether we really ever needed expanded housing. By 1976, we saw the upturn in enrollment, housing occupancy began to grow, and we started trying to alert some people and attract some attention to what we saw as an upcoming need. But I think, as in most situations, it's a squeaky wheel, and our wheel really started to make a lot of noise about 2 or 3 years ago when children of Alaskans were not able to get in rooms at their university. And, you know, that is certainly instrumental in getting us to where we are now. Well, there are lots of indicators that people look to, and I think there's some more that people don't see. We talk a lot about the impact of the pipeline, the construction of the pipeline, and that certainly was there, both for faculty and students and kitchen workers. You know, we had a difficult time maintaining any kind of stability during that time. We had another situation in 1972 where we had a real tragedy in the residence halls that happened about 4 days before final exams. And our occupancy dropped by 11% between fall and spring semesters just because of that. And in my mind, that was a lot of that drop. I think over the long haul, the pipeline impact, a kind of a shift that we saw at that time in high school students in Alaska going outside to school, especially the better students. We were having reputation and image problems. We were having retention problems. You know, we were probably our own worst enemy for a little period of time there. And I can say that the work of both Chancellor Cutler and Chancellor O'Rourke is really what's at play here in the upturn, the retention, and, you know, bright prospects.
Do you see continued growth?
Without question, yeah. I don't think there's a question about that. our applications, as I understand it from the registrar's office, our applications for admission from out of state are up, and obviously are up in state. New students, our surveys of high school seniors and juniors and their college plans annually turn more and more to going to school in state. The continued growth of the Alaska State Loan Program, the fact that we probably as a state have more of a financial opportunity for students to go to school. It's, at least that's not a stopper here like it is so often. You know, all of those things. And the fact that we have an excellent university, an excellent faculty, a tremendous reputation internationally in several majors, and continued improvement, continued accreditation, reaccreditation, everything points to a bright future. Well, all of the other facilities that we have, which is a network of 8 residence halls in varying configurations, are all very typical. They have a doorway that you enter and some stairs you climb and a bunch of rooms, which some students call cells and others call cubicles and so on. There are small amounts of square footage and no particular facilities, a bathroom down the hall and a laundromat down 3 floors down. These are not designed to be traditional dormitory residence facilities. These are designed to be apartments in the same way that a student or a person not going to college might want to go live in an apartment complex in town in Wedgewood Manor somewhere where they have their own flexibility to establish the kind of life that they want, with the difference being that all of the people in this complex will be students and have that in common. They're arranged in configurations of 2 bedrooms with a kitchen, living room, dining room, study area, and a bathroom. So there'll be 4 students per apartment. There will be completely equipped kitchens, including ranges and ovens and refrigerators and even a microwave, believe it or not. There will be several laundry facilities there, and they'll be furnished and within walking distance, in fact, very close to our existing married student complex. We've got good planning that's happened as far as parking, green belts, recreation areas, open spaces, and so on. I think they're going to be quite attractive. They're townhouse style. Within that complex are several apartments, 6 as a matter of fact, which are designed expressly for handicapped students and for students who need wheelchair assistance. So we think we're going to have a first-class operation complex there, and that'll be very popular. And students, of course, will be able to cook their own meals, which is really, you know, students as well as I do, and no matter how good of a job we do in the dining commons, there are a lot of people that want their peas cooked at a certain temperature and so much oregano and something else. And so this is going to give them a chance to do that. I don't have a good answer for that. Some of the programmatic things we are not positive about. It. Some of it depends on whether or not we actually open in August when we think we're going to open or whether it's delayed. We've toyed around with priorities. Who gets these units? Is it based on class standing? Should it be based on age? Should it be based on Alaskan residents and not? Should it be based on people with certain diets first who need the kitchens? We're not real sure on that one. It worked very well. We have, of course, surveyed a number of institutions. West Coast, Northern, small public and private schools that have apartment-style living for single-student residents. Generally, always positive. The few comments that we've heard are usually related to maturity. There are some students who have never had to take care of life's functions themselves and don't know how. And that those comments would hold true even in a residence hall, because you still have to put your clothes in the washing machine. And frankly, I think that just presents us a challenge. We're going to have to program into those buildings for very young students some information and some examples of how to live, and going back to ground zero and explaining some things. We anticipate less. We are not going to have, for instance, right now we do custodial in common areas as well as bathrooms and showers and so on. That is going to to not be available in the apartment residences. We're expecting students to keep them clean, well maintained, and you know, in fact, we're not really looking for wear and tear issue problems. There may be some maintenance that we don't see coming. For instance, we're going to have more furniture and more appliances, and so we're going to have breakdowns. We're going to have to get good at those kinds of repairs because we have four people depending on that range and oven. I don't know of others that I anticipate that haven't already been dealt with in the design. You haven't asked what they're going to look like, what color they're going to be. What if I told you they were going to be underground? Well, I think they're going to be, they're not typical Frank Lloyd Wright built into the tree trunks, but they are going to be very compatible with the environment, the habitat, the colors, and the amount of sun on the hill and so on. We've really taken everything we could into account to have a pleasant environment. I think that people are going to be very pleased and proud of them. Now, 110 parking spaces for 250 beds. Now you figure it out. We assume that they won't all have cars. We hope they won't.
The oral history index is really the first tool. It's to finding out what exists out there in the way of recordings. The index is developed here at Rasmussen Library based upon our inquiries and based upon information which people send us from all throughout the state. And it's the entree to where sources of information exist so that researchers and the interested public, whether the topic be something that happened yesterday or whether the topic be something that happened 150 years ago, that type of material is referenced in that index.
Okay. Now, of this material that you've gathered, and you say the index, how can I use the index? Let's start from there.
Well, suppose you're interested in reindeer. When you go to the index, there's a list of keywords. Reindeer is one of those keywords. And then you follow that to the citations, which alphabetically follow in natural order. And you'll see that there are many references to reindeer from the Seward Peninsula, from the North Slope, and from parts of the interior. The collections represented under reindeer include radio stations, individual research projects, and interviews by personnel here at the university. So there's a great deal of variety of different sources which can be brought to bear on the same question of reindeer. And that's true of many, many other topics. The bringing together, the sorting process, is critical in having the resources to any sort of balanced judgment on an issue. And we are in a position now with this oral history index to be able to do that type of sorting rather quickly.
Okay. Now, suppose I'm interested in, let's say, airplanes or reindeer or whatever, and I come and look in your index. Does that mean I can go right to Rasmussen Library and hear anything I want to?
No, the index references citations both here at Rasmussen and in other parts of the state. So, yes, you would be able to find some material here, but you would then know that you had to call different places or write different places to get those sources.
Okay, now these different sources, how readily available are these sources if they're in your index?
Some of them are quite readily available, those that are here, those that are in Fairbanks. Some of them, at a distance, you would have to send a blank tape and people would make a copy then. In some cases, the material is restricted, and that's listed, too, so that the people at the local level get a chance to protect the information that they've recorded. And so the material is, in one sense, more readily available than if it was not listed at all, but it is less readily available than if it was in hand. And we feel that that intermediate step of having to deal with someone where the collection exists is an important one, because that will give them an opportunity to do the filtering and sorting that they need to do, and will also give them a chance to give you some clues as to other sources.
Okay, now when we're talking about these collections and these tapes, what format are these oral history tapes in that you're indexing?
Some of them are on cassettes. Some of them are on reel-to-reel. Some of them are videotapes. We even have a couple wire recordings. And I think we've also indexed some films under this, although there are other programs that are indexing films.
Why? Someone asked this question before, but why are we doing this? Why are we putting this energy and this money into this project?
Because for Alaskans, the oral record, the record of what people have said in the past, is a very, very important record. It's very important to people's identity. It's very important to their sense of place. It's very important to their everyday activities to know how it fits in with what the elders have said who have come before them. There is an excitement about being in Alaska. There's an excitement about the activities of those that have come before us. And we here in Alaska, I think, really want to know what life was like at the personal level. And that's where oral history is at its best, at the personal level, you know, the personal experiences of the people, you know, and their perspectives on the earthquake, the flood, or the shooting of Soapy Smith or whatever. It's that eyewitness, firsthand account that is what makes oral history exciting.
Sounds good. What kind of quality are these tapes on? What, I mean, how is it quality where a person can use it for a radio show? What's the quality on them?
The quality varies. In some cases, the quality is very poor. In other cases, it's broadcast quality. It just depends on the particular collection. We attempt, when possible, to indicate that on our citation, but it varies. We have collections from federal agencies like the Forest Service and the National Park Service, from individual researchers, from groups like the Alaska Humanities Forum, a number and a great variety of different groups have made their collections available. And as the oral history program and as the index makes more popular this format, we get many more requests, and people begin to use us as a repository for their collection, knowing how fragile one-of-a-kind collections are, that they then become willing to have a collection here.
Do you have any program, like certain groups have, well, some of the film groups in the state will, if I will loan you my film, you'll make a copy and return it. Do you have any programs like that?
Yes, I'm very interested in that from the standpoint of tapes. I've had some very exciting cooperative agreements with individuals and radio stations where they're producing high-quality material. And we definitely want to obtain copies of that, and we're happy to have a copy and not the original, because that's the neat thing about oral history. In somewhat different fashion than a manuscript, a rare manuscript, the oral tape, if we have a good copy, a good quality copy, we don't need the original. We need to be concerned legally with making sure that the rights of the people who did the recording are protected. But the technology of copying original tape material is advanced enough to make that material readily available, and that's very exciting. It's exciting in terms of entertainment as well as educational scholastic work.
Sounds good. Now, let's go continue on oral history. Let me expand a little bit and go shift from the index itself. What is the total concept, what is the concept, we'll drop the word total, of the oral history project at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Rasmussen Library, Arctic and Polar Collision?
I'm glad that you asked that question. Our purpose in the oral history program, or what we call the Program for the Preservation of Oral History and Traditions, is to create collections which will assist researchers and the interested public in their pursuit of knowledge about Alaska and the North. At the same time, we wish to demonstrate how that record can be used to enhance the other historical sources, so that we actually do some recording and we develop some research projects, as well as archiving and index copying of other people's collections. So it's twofold. And I feel very strongly that this emphasis on preserving a record to last afterwards, as well as an analysis of that record, is going to change the way social scientists do research, those that choose to use that form of documentation, because it enables the researchers down the line in the future to go back and look at the original source material. And granted, they don't have the benefit of the complete context that the original researcher had, but they do have the chance to re-examine what people have said. And that's pretty exciting in terms of drawing new conclusions or testing new hypotheses. In the past, we had people's field notes, but they're never as complete as when someone's talking.
No argument at all. When you were talking about earlier, you were talking, referring to Alaska, a good place to do oral history or natural, I believe your words. Why is Alaska different from other parts of the country in this way? Or is it different?
Well, I think that the written record here is rather short. The paper trail, as Dr. Frederick used to refer to it, is limited in a way that it isn't in other parts of the United States, where people have been writing down what's going on for a long time. Here, the rich oral traditions have served to enhance people's appreciation of the past in the way that perhaps a written document did elsewhere. Although, we're finding that the rich oral traditions elsewhere played a very significant role. Here in Alaska, the native traditions, storytelling, legends, the time of year when a story is told, the pioneers who came with their special visions of who they were and their interests in having that preserved in the stories and tales, the even in the official records, you know, of government personnel who were so careful to write down what they were doing, they also had oral traditions which they passed on. And so I think there's something about being in Alaska that makes people want to reflect on it personally and share that reflection with others. And we do that, of course, in storytelling and in what we relate to our family and our friends and our close relatives. I hadn't really given a lot of thought to the psychological or social importance of this, except that I deal with it every day and I see it every day, and it seems quite clear to me that there's something special about the process of reflecting upon it.
It
feels a little stiff. I feel like I'm on the spot, and I realize now why people get tired after 5 or 10 minutes.
This sounds like one you definitely want for your own collections.
It's true, though. It is a different perspective, and I so rarely am in this position that it's good for me to be in it and have someone as good as you doing the recording.
Thanks. Flattery will get you somewhere. Still won't destroy the master. What hints or what guidelines would you give somebody who wants to go record Grandma?
The first step in recording is to find out what exists, what's been done on that subject or that individual, and to have a clear idea of what you want to do, and then to give Grandma or whoever it is enough time to think about what you want to ask them about. It's important to remember that in an hour interview or a 2-hour interview, you're not going to capture all of Grandma's life. It's going to be necessary to develop a full-fledged program, or to be aware that you're only going to capture a small part. It's also very important to know what you want to do with the recollections of Grandma once you've got them. I sometimes jokingly talk about putting Grandma in the shoebox under the bed and saying, I've captured her. And I think there is that tendency sometimes of people to feel that once they've got the recording made, that nothing more needs to be done. And there is more that needs to be done, because you have to provide the context for the listener or for the reader or whoever it is that's going to want to experience Grandma. So the job is really just beginning once you've got the recording. Then you've got to put it into an article, or put it into a radio show, or put it into a dramatization. In some way, you've got to communicate what Grandma said. You've only captured the words of Grandma on the tape. You've got to create the context then for her to be fully appreciated by the larger audience.
I've jumped around quite a bit, asked a variety of different questions. Is there anything that I've left out that you would like to mention, or anything that I've stimulated that we skipped over?
I think your questions were really excellent. I think we probably can leave it at that.
I have a couple more questions.
Okay.
One of them is, what care are you taking of the physical tapes? How are you taking care of them?
We store the tapes down here in the archives, and we attempt to, whenever a patron or person comes in and wishes to listen to a tape, we attempt to have them listen to a copy instead of the original. That's not always possible, but whenever it is possible, we try to do that so that the original is preserved. The tapes are stored in an atmosphere that is as close to fire protection as we can provide. It's atmospherically controlled in terms of humidity, and we are protected as best we can against flooding and against robbery, and the alarm system down here is quite extensive. So they receive the best protection that we can possibly provide, because they, like the rare books and the manuscripts and the maps, are cherished possessions. And that's the responsibility of the archivist and head of the Alaskan Polar Regions Department, Paul McCarthy. He oversees the operation here and ensures the security of the collections.
Is this going to be an ongoing program at the library, or is it a flash in the pan that's funded by one year?
This is an ongoing program. We have permanent funding to continue to do this important work. And I like to think that as long as people have important things to say, and there's someone there recording it, that the oral history program will be appropriately capturing that record.
I thank you for your time.